Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
The 1930s socialite Florence Foster Jenkins couldn't sing a note, but that didn't stop her from building a remarkable singing career. Others suffering from tone deafness, though, find it much less easy. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. The roots of tone deafness on today's show. Also, hear why Brooklyn's Chairlift is standing out from the indie rock crowd when the trio performs live in our studio. But first, if you've ever sung a round of Happy Birthday and were scolded for having a tin ear, that may not be entirely true. A new study published in the Journal of Neuroscience suggests that tone deafness, the inability to sing on key, may be the result of a missing connection in the brain. Anywhere from 4 to 17% of the population is said to be tone deaf, so this research could have far-reaching implications for the afflicted. We'll get two views today. In a moment, a voice teacher who works with tone deaf students will join us. But first on the line is Dr. Psyche Louie, the lead author of the study at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center and Harvard Medical School. And Psyche, I understand you're a musician yourself. First of all, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you.
So
great to be here.
What were you looking for, and what did you find when you and your colleagues did these brain scans of 20 people, half of whom were tone deaf?
So we were interested in differences between brain structures that might predict why tone deaf people sing out of tune and seem to have problems controlling their own voice. So what we did was we did diffusion imaging, which is a kind of MRI scan, mm-hmm. on 10 tone deaf and 10 non-tone deaf people, and we showed that there were differences in connectivity between perception and motor brain regions. So in general, the regions that you use to hear and the regions that you use to produce sounds were not as well connected in the tone-deaf people compared to controls.
So there's a wiring problem, a faulty wiring.
Problem. Yes.
And do you know what causes that?
So that's a very interesting question. It does seem that some tone deafness might have genetic origins. So it's more likely to run in the family, even after you control for musical training. And we also think there might be some differences in exposure, maybe early on in life, if some children are not exposed to as much pitched information when their brains are developing in these areas, then they might these brain areas might not talk as efficiently to each other, and then that might lead to this disconnection syndrome.
That's interesting, because I know there are some neuroscientists now who, you know, theorize that at birth our brains can handle any combination of, like, pitches. You know, if you're born in India, it doesn't mean you're going to grow up knowing what Indian scales are like,
right,
as opposed to European. It's what you're accustomed to hearing as a kid. So are you suggesting that someone who doesn't hear enough pitched information, enough musical information as a child, that these connections might just kind of atrophy?
I think that it might be atrophy. It might be that the normal brain prunes its connections in a certain way that people who don't have enough exposure, not just with listening to pitches, but also with producing pitches, might have. So definitely there's all kinds of research showing that there's a lot of sensitivity to pitch information from a very young age. So, you know, that's supposed to be how you learn music, and that's also supposed to be how you learn languages. But it also might be that in some people, they are less aware of their own voices and also of pitch specifically in environmental sounds. So that might lead to you could say atrophy, or maybe just a underdevelopment relative to the normal population.
And if it turns out that tone deafness is, as your study suggests, the result of a wiring problem, is that something you can fix? Are there brain electricians who can go in there and run new circuits and stuff?
Yeah, I think it might be a curable disorder or disconnection syndrome. So there's a lot of evidence for neuroplasticity, which means that the brain can change itself even after you're pretty much grown up. So, for instance, there's some research from our lab, showing that after a stroke, some people have aphasia, which means they can't talk. And it turns out that if you sing to them and you train them to sing over long periods of time, they can regain some of these speech functions. So suggesting that the grown-up brain does have some rewiring capabilities. So I think, you know, music lessons and a lot of training might strengthen some of these connections back.
Okay, we're speaking with Dr. Psyche Louie, who is the one of the authors of this new study in the Journal of Neuroscience, suggesting that tone deafness is actually the result of faulty wiring in the brain. You studied 20 people, half of whom were tone deaf, and you have an example here of a tone deaf person singing Happy Birthday. What do you listen for that suggests this person is tone deaf as opposed to simply not being musically trained?
Oh, that's a great question. So there are people are actually usually quite good at first matching pitches. So if you give them a certain pitch, they're very good at, say, at reproducing that pitch. And then furthermore, people are usually quite good at reproducing intervals. So if you give them a difference, two tones, they can usually produce the difference. So not just each pitch in itself, but also the relationship between pitches. This individual was generally squishing the very small, the very large intervals into smaller intervals, and also making the small intervals bigger. So everything ends up being kind of like they're talking. It's not exactly monotone, but it's just like they're speaking. And this is quite typical of tone deaf people singing, because if you listen to them talking, they pretty much sound normal. But if you listen very, very carefully, then there might be some differences in how they articulate a question versus a statement, for instance. So there are some fine-grained differences, and this is shown in the way she sings.
Okay, so this is a tone-deaf person singing familiar melody.
Happy birthday to you, happy birthday to you, happy birthday, dear Psyche, happy birthday to you.
So that's one of the subjects from Psyche Louie's study into tone deafness. Soundcheck listeners, are you tone deaf, or do you have some experience with it? Do you have ways of coping with it? We'd like to hear from you. You can leave a comment on the Soundcheck page at WNYC.org, or you can give us a call, 212-433-WNYC. That's 433-9692. Psyche Louie is with us on the line, and joining me in the studio is Deborah Lapidus. She teaches singing to actors at the drama division of the Juilliard School and NYU's Tisch School of the Arts. And Deb, I imagine that means you have your fair share of actors who have not had a whole lot of singing, musical training.
Scary in the moment to meet up with them and try to figure out how to help them.
Now, how often does this happen in the course of your work?
I would say in any class of usually 18 people in a class, maybe every other class there's one. Occasionally there's two. There was one class at Juilliard where there were two, and that was a lot.
How big is a class?
18 people.
Okay. Psyche, we've been told that anywhere from 4 to 17% of the population can be classified as tone deaf. That's an awfully broad range. Can you narrow that down for us a bit?
Yes. So the original definition of congenital amusia, which is one term that could be used for tone deafness, is 4%. So if you took people and you gave them some different melodies, and you ask them to tell whether some melodies are same or different, there's about 4% of people who fail at that test, you know, according to some criteria that were published since the 80s. However, if you just ask the normal population, do you think you're tone deaf? 17% of the population says yes.
Really?
Now, yeah. Yeah. So this was done among the college students, and it was shown that the 17%
because
of the normal
population. I think, Psyche, there's a lot of people out there who know people who are tone deaf who think that they're great singers.
Right.
Deb,
yes.
I mean,
I actually think the opposite. I think more people think they're tone deaf than actually are tone deaf, because they've been told for so many years and they have so much anxiety around their history with pitch and pitch reproduction.
Yes.
So those people then perhaps are not genetically, or you know, maybe they don't have the actual wiring problem that psyche study is talking
right.
about. Maybe.
Yeah,
so
I mean, it's hard.
What do you do with that with
well,
those people?
You know, it's hard for me to know if they have brain troubles or if they're just having, you know, problems
yeah.
being kind of connected to their instrument and their body and their ears, you know?
Right.
So
I think a lot of people are very self-conscious about it. Now that,
oh, yeah.
And a lot of people think they can hear a lot of people can hear the differences just fine. They just have trouble training their voices to hit the right notes. That's not what we would call tone deafness. So being a poor pitch producer is a little bit different from not being able to tell the differences between two tones, which is what we call tone deaf.
And Deb, the challenge facing you is, as you say, you don't know whether there's an underlying
brain problem
in the brain
right.
or whether it's...
And in some level, it can't actually concern me because all I can do is try to help these people get better to the best of my ability. So
in what
a way,
do you do?
Well, most of the time, people come in with a lot of trauma, literally, and they're terrified to actually get up and sing. So often what I do is to try to actually make them think they're not singing. I have to trick them into thinking they're not singing because singing is so terrifying and gives them so much sort of agitation that they can't do it.
So what do they think they're doing?
They think they're actually, we do a lot of work on inflection. So I have them inflect. I actually have them first listen to a song that I want them to sing, to record it and just listen to it over and over again and tell them not to sing it. And then after they do that for a while, I have them get up and just actually inflect pitches on rising inflections. And often what happens as they inflect and the piano is playing under them, they start to actually match pitch for part of the song. And it's kind of amazing. The room kind of goes in awe because they actually are singing, even though they think they're just inflecting. If I then ask them to sing, they would not be able to actually match. So then we actually talk about, then I ask them to inflect from the level of the notes. We talk about energy, vocal energy, higher energy and lower energy rather than higher pitch and lower pitch. And that's a way I can have a lot of success with that.
The question of pitch, Psyche, leads to the question of languages like Chinese,
mm-hmm.
some African languages, which are pitched languages, where the difference in inflection can completely change the meaning of what to us would be, you know, two versions of the same word.
Right.
Are there any studies into whether, you know, tone deafness among people who speak those languages is more or less than among English speakers?
Yes. Well, there is some evidence. I don't think it's published yet, but I know of some new data showing that among tone language speakers, such as Chinese, you know, Mandarin Chinese or Cantonese or Thai and so on, those people are less likely to have tone deafness.
Maybe because as youngsters, as infants, they've
yes.
been exposed to all of that pitched information.
Right, absolutely.
So in terms of... poor old English speakers, Deb, inflection is for you, that's the way to bridge that gap between speech and song?
Yeah, that really helps me. But there's one other thing that's interesting, which is when I work with a man, he will often, who seems to be tone deaf, he will, and I sing to him, he will try to match my register. So he's up in this crazy high register. Because, and then I think, well, maybe he has an amazing ear because most men who can sing will just put it in their own register, an octave
yeah,
lower.
They do an octave.
There's something about, they're actually hearing it in some really acute way, it feels like. And then I have to have a man sing it to them. So if I'm working with a man, I sometimes have a man in the room sing to the man. It's easier that way.
Let's put a man on the line. Barry is joining us from Union, New Jersey, and Barry tells us that he is totally tone deaf.
Okay.
Barry, what does that mean, actually?
I am abysmally tone deaf. I can't repeat a song, anything resembling the original tune. I can't recognize a tune or be able to repeat it to somebody else as far as the song goes.
Do you enjoy music?
I adore music. I've taken guitar lessons. And after about a year, the guy put his arm around me and said, "Hey, Bear, I love you. Come by, say hello, but you'll never learn to play."
Wow. Deb, what would you do with Barry? What would you start him off with?
Well, I think I would just actually love to hear Barry sing at some point. Barry, you might beg to differ, but you know.
Lady.
But it affected your guitar playing, too? I mean, instrumentally,
yes.
You couldn't do it, even when the
pitches
are...
Oh, no, technically I can do it.
I mean, but on instruments, you're all right?
No. Piano, I was abysmal. My mother forced me into lessons at the age of 5. The guy finally gave up.
How old were you when you found out you couldn't sing or felt you couldn't sing or were told?
As far back, I wasn't told. I just...
You knew?
I've been in shows. I've sang in shows, you know, class shows and things, and people draw arrows for me up and down, and I follow the arrows up and down.
Could you tell that you're singing out of tune when people tell you?
Pretty much. Mm. I'm also abysmal at languages. I've taken 9 years of French, and I'm reasonably bright, and terrible. I find that people who are tone deaf generally are poor in languages as well, and I always sort of assumed it was auditory memory that was involved.
Well, Psyche, have you found that in your research as well, Psyche, that there is a kind of diminished language skill among people who are seriously tone deaf?
Yeah, so there's some research showing that people who are tone deaf have difficulty discriminating speech contours. So as I was saying, they can't tell a question from a statement. And also, there might be some links, but there's definitely a lot of overlap between music and language in the brain. This is at every level, so either at the pitch level or higher in the syntax level, like how you put different notes together, how you put different chords together, how you put nouns and verbs together, are probably using very much similar parts of the brain. So I think there might be some an elevated incidence of tone deafness among dyslexics, for instance. And both of those might be attributable to some auditory echoic memory problem.
We're speaking with Dr. Psyche Louie, who's the lead researcher in this study just published in the Journal of Neuroscience that suggests that tone deafness actually has an underlying wiring problem in the brain to blame, and also with Deborah Lapidus, who's a voice instructor in the drama division at the Juilliard School and at NYU's Tisch School for the Arts. And Peter is joining us on the line from Jersey City. Peter, I understand you're a linguist, so you're coming at this from a slightly different angle, right?
Right. Billions of people in the world speak tone languages. You mentioned Chinese and Igbo in Nigeria and Swedish and plenty of others, but English is a tonal language too, except we put the tones on whole sentences and not on individual words. And Barry, who called before and claimed to be tone deaf, was using the English intonation patterns perfectly normally, and also has no trouble in understanding questions versus statements and so on. And I have never heard of anyone among the billions of tone language speakers in the world who is unable to distinguish tones in their spoken language.
I think the distinction is a little more subtle than, somebody speaking completely in a monotone way. What the researchers actually did in the initial study showing that tone deaf people couldn't tell prosodic content, which English does have, right? So there's a lot of pitch inflections in Barry's speech and in tone deaf people's speech. But what initially the researchers did was low-pass filter the sound wave files of people speaking so that it was really left with the prosodic content, which is the pitch information.
Mm-hmm.
And when you do that, then the tone deaf people couldn't tell the differences.
So they needed the content, in other words.
Exactly. So they use a lot of other information like context. And there are some tone deaf people who've had violin training for 8 years, right? So how do they do it? Or piano training. So I think a lot of what people learn to do is take the context and use it. So, for instance, they could use their other motor programming so they could know where to put the finger when, and that's different from actually using it, like playing some piece or singing and then using their auditory feedback to adjust what they do.
Have you ever tested Chinese Mandarin speakers and found anyone who can't tell the four tones apart?
I haven't found anyone who can't tell the four tones apart, but I have definitely come across Mandarin Chinese-speaking tone-deaf people.
But don't know what you mean by tone-deaf, because if they speak and understand Chinese...
There's the question.
Yeah, so our paper last year showed that tone-deaf people actually have abilities to produce pitches, but they don't have abilities to fine-tune pitches.
Well, that's quite different.
Right. They could do. They could talk normally, but then they couldn't hear what they just said. So there's no auditory awareness of what just happened.
So there are many things that can come out of this research, but one of them might be that we need to fine-tune our definition of what tone deaf means. Joel Meyer, our soundcheck producer, is, as he often is, in the control room, moderating the comments that are coming in on the soundcheck page. What you got, Joel?
John, there are a lot of questions on the soundcheck page, but basically they all come down to one thing, people asking, am I tone deaf? There are two comments from people that sort of fall in kind of a gray area that we were talking about just a second ago, both offering comments that really are just kind of a catharsis. Molly from New Jersey writes, I can hear whether something is not in tune, but when I sing, I can't make my voice be in tune. It's just a disaster. When I sing Happy Birthday, it's worse than your example. And Jack, who apparently is listening in Greece, as in the country, writes, I think I need some help. I play the bass in a rock and roll band. When I tried to sing, it was also a disaster. The other members of the band suggested that next to the bass, I should write no voice. And Jack continues, on the other hand, I can understand if an instrument needs to be tuned. I can also sing some tunes in the right way. So what's happening? Am I tone deaf?
All right, these are questions that we're going to come back to in just a moment, because that is the big question. What does it mean when we say tone deaf? Deb, you actually taught Claire Danes. You coached her to do some singing for this film called Evening.
Mm-hmm.
And any problems? I mean, did she come to you sort of fully formed? Or?
No, but she had a great ear and was easy to work with. And as a dancer, what she is, you know, she's a really trained dancer. She has a great awareness of her body, which really helps in singing. So she was really easy and just had a good ear. But I wonder also about some of the things that you're talking about in terms of people feeling that they're tone deaf, because sometimes people do not have very flexible voices.
Well, let's hold that thought for a minute, because I want to come back to that, because now we're talking about voice control as opposed to an actual pathology in the wiring of the brain. But here is Claire Danes singing pretty well.
I was happy with it.
The song is Time After Time.
So lucky to be the one you run to see in the evening when the day is through.
In a moment, we continue our look at tone deafness. And then coming up later, the group Chairlift. They got a big boost last year when this song made its way into an iPod commercial. We'll hear them play live in our studio later on Soundcheck.
I tried to do handstands for you. I tried to do headstands for you. Every time I fell on you, yeah, every time I fell. I tried to do handstands for you, but every time I fell for you, I'm permanently black and blue, permanently blue for you.
End is near. Soundcheck's video contest ends at midnight tonight, so enter today. Details on the homepage at WNYC.org.
I could feel at the time there was no way of knowing. Fallen leaves in the night, who can say where they're blowing? As free as the wind, hopefully learning why the sea.
In the film Lost in Translation, Bill Murray's character manages to impress Scarlett Johansson at karaoke despite this less than tuneful singing. I'm betting Deb didn't work with him before this gig. But to hear an actual tone-deaf singer, the experience can be far more excruciating, and a new study published in the Journal of Neuroscience reveals that the condition may be the result of a wiring problem in the brain. We've been joined by Psyche Louie, the lead author of the study, and by Deborah Lapidus, who teaches singing to actors at the drama division of the Juilliard School. And we're hearing from our Soundcheck listeners online, the comments page at WNYC.org, and on the phone at 212-433-WNYC. Before the break, Psyche, Deb, we heard from Jack, the bass player in Greece, talking about how, you know, he's able to, I mean, he has a regular gig with a band playing the guitar, the bass guitar, but when he tries to sing, absolute disaster. So, you know, this gets us back to the question that we've been circling for a while, which is, what does it mean to be tone deaf as opposed to being someone who simply does not have the training or the physical control of their voice. Deb?
Well, to me, I would have to say that that would be a process, that you would start with someone, and then if you spend a length of time with them and you get absolutely nowhere, I guess I would say they're tone deaf. For instance, there was this one guy I worked with who could only sing the higher notes, okay? He couldn't get any of the lower notes. So when you first heard him, you thought, my God, he's totally tone deaf. But then when you listened, you realized there was a range of pitch that he could match. But then lower tones, no matching whatsoever. It was almost like he couldn't feel that part of his own voice. And he had a relatively high speaking voice, too. So there was something about that that was just off.
Psyche, does that sound to you like maybe there was, some wiring problem at work?
There probably was some wiring problem at work. I think that what tone deafness is actually probably an amalgam of many different disconnections or disorders. So you could start with basically a pitch discrimination problem. So if you can't tell an A from a B flat, you think those two sound the same, then that is a threshold that is much, much worse, larger than the normal population. So the normal population is able to tell pitch differences that are much smaller than one semitone. So that could be one type, but it doesn't seem like Jack, like bass player, had that particular problem. So another thing that one could have is potentially specifically in voice control, which, so that might be different from pitch discrimination problem. And then a third kind of thing that somebody might have is in the way that pitches can be put together to form melodies. So there really are probably more than one type of tone deafness, and you could see how some people might have one but not the other. So a good bass player or guitar player or piano player might have very good musicality, but then be unable to put those pitches into their voice.
And without access to an MRI and all the other fancy gizmos, it's you're basically just dealing with it symptomatically. Let's take a call from Lois, who joins us from Mamaroneck. Lois, are you tone deaf?
Well, I think I am. When I was in grade school, I used to be in the chorus, just a regular chorus. Mm-hmm. And it came through that over the years that I began to realize that I was in the chorus because I sang loud, not because I could sing on tune. And what made me realize that was that when I was a young adult, I was a counselor at a day camp. I was actually a unit head in charge of three counselors at a day camp. And on one rainy day, I told my three counselors they could take an hour off and I would take care of the kids on my own. And I spent an hour with them. And the next day, we went on one of these field trips that you go on with in day camps, and all the counselors and the kids were in the bus, and they were all singing the songs that they knew. And they came to one song that they started to sing, and these three counselors all started to laugh because they knew that the kids had not known that song the day before and that I clearly had taught them the song, and they were singing the song on one note. And I thought I was teaching them a song with a melody. I had no concept of that. And another example that I had was that my ex-husband was taking clarinet lessons, and one of my sons was taking cornet lessons. And if I was in the other room, I could not tell which of those two instruments was playing. And people said, well, they're so different. I said, well, you blow them both. They said, no, but one is a reed and one is a... But at any rate, my ear could not distinguish between those two instruments.
Lois, thanks very much. Psyche, I mean, as you said, there are like three different levels that we could be talking about here. And it can be very difficult just on the basis of a few anecdotes to try and figure out what's at play in any of these folks that we're speaking to today.
Right.
I have a final question, actually, Deb, for you, which is, in these days of pitch correction and auto-tune and stuff, does it matter anymore to the people in your trade, the actors who come to see you?
Yeah, I think it does matter because I think pitch correction is an amazing thing, but I think they can only do so much. I mean, you can correct something to a certain extent and then it doesn't sound human anymore, So, yeah, and I think an expressive voice is a wonderful thing,
Well, perhaps at some point we'll have a cure for tone deafness. First, we have to define exactly what it means. And Psyche Louie, instructor in neurology at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center at Harvard Medical School, is hard at work on that. Deborah Lapidus, meanwhile, down in the trenches with the actors who have to sing their way through these shows. She is a voice instructor in the drama division at the Juilliard School and the NYU Tisch School of the Arts. Psyche, Deb, thank you both for being with us on Soundcheck today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And still to come, a live performance in our studio from the Brooklyn-based electronic pop trio, Chairlift. And tune in tomorrow as we debate the existential question posed to so many guitarists: to shred or not to shred. Join us for a Soundcheck Smackdown debate on guitar solos tomorrow.